even more important with adolescents, is these things will nail your appetite. And we really don't know what the effect of this decreased appetite is on kids over a very long period of time.
Are you raising your family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Or do you ask, where's the roadmap to building a happy, healthy life? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. If you've been hearing the buzz about weight loss medications for kids and teens, you're not alone. The headlines are everywhere, but the facts can be so hard to follow. We're talking about what these medications are, how they work, who they're for, and just as importantly, what they aren't. Whether you're a parent, a pediatrician, or just curious about the headlines, this conversation is your roadmap through the noise. And that's why I've invited back one of our favorite guests, Dr. Christopher Bowling, a national expert on childhood obesity, to break it all down. Chris, it's always great to talk to you.
It's the feeling is mutual, Sarah. I love being here.
Thank you again for joining us. I want to start by highlighting the big picture. So we know that today, nearly one in five U.S. youths are living with obesity. And these numbers are rising, especially in severe cases. And in response, the American Academy of Pediatrics, or otherwise we talk about AAP, released some new guidelines. And in that guidelines, they talk about medications for treatment options, even starting at the age of 12, alongside healthy lifestyle changes, right? Right. And I just saw in an article, I don't know if you saw it, in the AAP Daily Briefs, that there was a report that these prescriptions are jumping 50% among teens in the past year alone. Why do you think there's such a jump in these scripts, Chris?
You know, there really is a big jump in them, Sarah. It's really fascinating. And I saw that same article. We'll send the link to everybody.
Great.
It's a really good article. It has a really nice accompanying video. Also, it's on Reuters. And a colleague of mine at Cincinnati Children's sent it to me. And it's just a really nice little piece that talks about the pros and cons of the medication and the lifeline that it's been for certain kids. You know, I think it's one of those things that we have been aching for something to help these kids. A lot of us as pediatricians and parents, quite honestly, saw kids with severe obesity. And as you said, severe obesity has just taken off. As we've seen the obesity epidemic multiply, the most severely affected and the fastest growing group are those kids who really do have severe obesity. So I think the rapid uptake in this has been really a sense of alarm by families, by patients, by pediatricians, by family practitioners, of that these are kids and adults too, obviously, where we really, they're on a fast track to really bad health outcomes, to diabetes, to heart disease, to orthopedic issues, to all those, and not only just health indicators per se, but also those quality of life indicators.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our patients who have severe obesity feel just stigmatized and isolated and embarrassed and ashamed. And it's just a horrible place to be residing for some of our patients. We're not talking about patients who carry a little bit of extra weight and are totally fine and are happy and are thriving. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
But I think the rapid uptake has been this need has really pushed the rapid uptake, honestly.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, it reminds me of a patient that I had, and I felt so bad for her during lunch, because she just felt like people would judge her just for eating, period. So eating her lunch, she would go to her car when she was in high school and sit in her car and eat because she was afraid that just by eating, even if it was something that was nourishing or healthy, that people would judge her and think, wow, you're eating. Right. So we often forget about those psychological aspects too.
Yeah. You know, I think of things like, you know, we're pediatricians, right? We're supposed to be very compassionate and empathic and always say the right thing. And I think of some of the terrible things. I've been doing pediatric obesity work for a long time, been a pediatrician since the 80s. And so, you know, I think of some of the stupid, hurtful things that I said early on.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking I was trying to motivate or help. I think I put on my old swim coach hat. And I'm, you got to do this. You got to do that. I'm like, you know what? That does not work. And as somebody who struggles with weight myself, I'm like, you should know better than that. But, you know, I think the bias that these kids feel is real. It's not just a perception, it's reality.
Yeah, and then I feel like then it just becomes this double-edged sword, because the stress and the anxiety and the emotions that they carry, what do most people, that's one of the causes of overeating too, I hate to say. And then I know I'm a stress eater. Like when I feel a lot of emotion, I tend to do that. So let's start. What are these medications and where did they really come from? Like, how did we all of a sudden get to notice that these are discovered?
Well, you know, these medications are like a lot of our medications, Sarah. They kind of came out of, there's a group of them. It's not just one medication. There's a whole family of anti-obesity medicines. And so we're seeing a lot of confusing sometimes messages and confusion on the part of pediatricians. Like, I can't possibly manage all these things. And it's complicated. Like everything in obesity, it's complicated. The last time we talked about how those of us in obesity medicine are chaos lovers. Well, the medications are the same story. It's great that there's a lot of options out there, but there are a whole bunch of them. So, and they kind of come down two pathways. You know, like there's the group of medications that we sort of accidentally fell into. You know, like there are the medications that are in the little bit of the stimulant class, like phentermine, that's been around for a while. It's a relative, it's sort of an amphetamine type effect that we knew had an appetite suppressive effect.
There's
also a medication called topiramate that you and I know from the anti-seizure world, from anticonvulsant effects, topiramate that has a pretty good impact on weights of, on appetite suppression as well. The mechanism we don't know. So a lot of these things, there's a group of medications that came out that we sort of went like, oh, these also have this effect. So like a lot of medications, you know, like medication like, you know, like minoxidil, like, you know, that we realize have these other effects that we then can use by using in lower doses, et cetera. You know, aspirin for heart disease, like I said, minoxidil for hair regrowth, those kinds of things that were side effects. Then there's another group of medications as we begin to understand more about human physiology, and it is so complicated. It's so complicated.
All the reductive
stuff around it. I'm just like, I just kind of roll my eyes because I'm like, you know, this is so complicated. But the other branch that's coming down the line is people that are beginning to understand, how do we affect the hypothalamus? How do we affect hormonal regulation of things like GLP-1 or gastrointestinal peptide? Some of the other ones, melanocorticoid receptors. Wow. There's a lot of really complicated things that are happening in the hypothalamus. There are genetic causes for obesity. So there's a group of very specialized medications that are developed in the lab. And then there are also sort of these accidental players, all of which have certain zones where they can be pretty effective.
So what I hear you saying is that some of these medications were treating other things.
Correct.
Like you mentioned, topiramate, I actually took it for migraines in the past. And what they found and discovered is that one of the side effects was weight loss. So they went, this is interesting. Let's look into this more. And for those that are listening, I want to let you know what GLP-1 stands for. It's glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist. So I thought I would just mention it. But most people just talk about, you know, just say GLP-1. And that's really fascinating because I think if I recall, you know, that particular medication was really something that they were using to treat diabetes, for example, or that was one of the therapeutic uses. And then they saw the weight loss and they thought, hey, this is something. This is, we might be able to really use this and help those with severe obesity. And I guess then the next question is, who should actually get these medications?
Well, you know, and as you said, too, like those GLP-1s, it's okay just to take a little aside on that, because I think yeah. there's a really interesting history around those. The GLP-1s, which are the ones that, you know, we all talk about. We say the brand names here, but things like semaglutide, liraglutide, tirzepatide, which yeah. is different, too. They're all a little, but I'll have a wrinkle in that. I threw it in with GLP-1s, but it's a little more than a GLP-1, that last one, tirzepatide.
Yeah.
We, you know, these medications, like you say, they were found to be useful in type 2 diabetes. And this weight loss effect was a little bit, in some ways, a little counterintuitive because one of the things that it does is they increase insulin secretion sometimes.
Okay.
We think of insulin as a growth hormone. So everybody's kind of going like, well, how does that cause weight change? It's like what's going on with that? So there was a lot of confusion, and there's still confusion. There's still a lot of questions to be answered, but there are a lot of these medications, like you say, that have two different doses when used for, basically it's the same medication, but it'll have two different names. That will be used from liraglutide is a classic example of that, where it's got a formulation that is used for diabetes control and then a formulation that is used for weight management.
Okay.
And now we're kind of going into and trying to figure out how do we make this weight loss effect more pronounced. So as they get sort of honed and changed and different analogs come out.
So then when we're talking to these families that are listening and even like pediatricians like ourselves, the next question is, when do we start thinking about that in regards to other, because we know it's not the only thing, correct?
Sure. It is never meant to be used as an only thing. And that's very clear in the guideline that you mentioned earlier. There's a lot of interesting history around that one too. We were all surprised at the results of our lit search on that. One of the hallmark pieces one of the most important statements in the clinical practice guideline is never use medication in isolation.
Okay.
That's important for several reasons. Number one, they're not effective. If you have the same eating habits, you can eat through the effect.
Yes.
You really want to make sure that you're doing something that is good, good weight loss that are good weight loss behavioral lifestyle strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And even more important with adolescents is these things will nail your appetite. And we really don't know what the effect of this decreased appetite is on kids over a very long period of time. I mean, are you going to get malnourished? Because, you know, a lot of them just, their appetites really go down dramatically. And we can still give them really good nutrition, but they have to pay attention to it. They right. can't just stop eating. I mean, that's like, you know, you and I both know that when kids have eating disorders, they lose muscle mass.
It's true. And that does worry me some, because if, you know, that it does, if they're not eating, or, you know, we want to also encourage that healthy lifestyle, of course. And that's getting back to what I was talking about before, is that we really want to know kind of what is causing the overeating, what is the genetics, all the things, all the pieces of the puzzle. So as you mentioned, this is not the one-stop shop. This is just one piece of the puzzle that they really need to consider, including sleep and movement and water. And there are side effects to these medications as well. But before we talk about that, I agree with you. There is concern about muscle wasting, and also concern that I worry that maybe some will use it, adult or adolescents, just for appearances versus actually a treatment for severe obesity.
I agree. You know, this, as we were mentioning, this is really reserved for our patients with severe obesity. This is all about health, right? So, you know, this is really about helping those kids where weight is dramatically affecting their health. So this is something that, you know, this is really reserved for our patients with severe obesity. This is not about taking the raglutide so you can look good in the next movie that you're in.
Yeah, or prom.
That stuff. The GLP-1s are the famous ones that everybody talks about. And those are the ones that are, you know, people talk about them for cosmetic reasons. So I don't think we should deny the cosmetic reasons why people do this. We all have a certain amount of vanity.
Sure.
And we all conform to societal norms, which are really messed up. So, you know, I think that we don't want to minimize why our patients might be doing these things, but it really is about health. And it really is important. That's why the statement is in there, never done in isolation, never as a single modality sort of treatment. It should always be done in consort with good exercise, good nutrition, good sleep, and good social connectivity.
If you like today's episode so far and it hits close to home for you, please like and subscribe to the podcast. It just takes one click. And please share with other parents. And if you have topics you'd like me to discuss here on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah, reach out to us and leave us a voice message. Instructions are in the description box below. Stick around, there's more to this conversation. Absolutely, I agree 100%. And I also want to say there are side effects. So let's start talking about those. What have you noticed in either the literature or even in practice or from what you're hearing from parents or colleagues?
Well, you know, and it's not really just in the literature. We actually see these things. It's, you know, and it's, as I mentioned, this is a very broad group of medications. It's not just the GLP-1s that everybody talks about. Although there tend to be GI type side effects, gastrointestinal side effects.
Yeah.
Vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, nausea, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There also are some rare complications. There's one of the rare complications is pancreatitis, which, as you and I both know, is not a fun complication.
No, not at all.
I was reading an article the other night about a vision complication from GLP-1.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, that can actually cause, it's a non-vascular type of optical blindness. So very, very scary kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't totally clear to me what the irreversibility is on these kind of side effects. So the GLP-1s have their group. The other ones also, like I mentioned to you, there are several other medications in this class that of anti-obesity medications that can have other side effects too, like we mentioned topiramate as its own group, the amphetamine group, the phentermine group. That group tends to have issues around agitation or anxiety or accelerated heart rate, can have an issue with blood pressure. So these are decisions not to be taken lightly. You know, and as I keep saying, this is a very complicated chronic disease.
Yes.
And some of the medications that we use, like some of the stimulants that we use to control ADHD, binge eating disorder is probably related in some way.
Mm-hmm.
We use a medication called lisdexamfetamine to treat ADHD. We also use it to treat binge eating disorder. And, you know, those side effects as well, where you have to watch blood pressure, you have to watch for sleep issues. There's a whole variety of things. And I think it's one of the things that makes pediatricians a little bit nervous about this category of medications, rightly so. We want them, you know, if you're not comfortable with these medications, you really want to be cautious with them.
I would agree. I would agree. And I appreciate you sharing all of those things. I also want to share, there was an article that I'd like to quote. It said, GLP-1 receptor agonist for treatment of pediatric obesity, behavioral health considerations. And what they were looking at was that using these among adolescents and really looking at the behavioral health considerations in this vulnerable population, and not just the medical side effects, but what are the psychosocial effects of this, you know, on obesity and also their own behavior. And basically, the bottom line, the conclusion that I saw from this article was that really more research needs to be done because we want to optimize the psychosocial outcomes for these youth. So not just physical changes that we see with these medications, but also psychological changes as well.
I couldn't agree more, you know, and I think we as pediatricians are pretty good at dealing with those things and being alert to those things. In my time at Children's Hospital, when I worked in the bariatric surgery division, I used to work with these great people, Stavros Synthakos, Helmut Rohrig, Meg Zeller, and the three of them had a really good handle on what was going on with our kids psychologically after they would have bariatric surgery and have dramatic weight loss. And they really reported, they were some of the first people to really report that a lot of our female patients were winding up having, you know, had very high rates of teen pregnancy afterwards.
Really?
Brand new, you know, it was a brand new experience for them in terms of, you know, that whole world opening up to them that they, it was, we kind of called it the sort of this butterfly effect.
Interesting.
And I think it was just for us, it was just a big reminder from the work that they did in kind of delineating this, that it was a big aha moment for all of us that we knew, but just like, yes, we have to really pay attention to what is going on psychologically with these patients. And I think that's someplace where, you know, kids, this is especially important. They really need to know what this is, what the possibilities are. They really need to go into it with as much ability to assent to treatment as they can. They can't give legal consent because they're not 18, but it's something that, you know, they really need to be on board with.
It makes me think about the fact that for some adolescents and even adults, that this is part of their identity. And all of a sudden, we're taking away this piece of identity. I know we're going deep with that thought, you know.
But but that is very true. I mean, you know, like they've defined themselves in some ways by this issue.
Yeah.
You know, we are our diagnosis, right? You know, we are. It is part and parcel of who we are. So it is a big step when that goes away. Yes, it causes problems. Yes, it causes this, but it's part of who we are. You know, I think it's interesting. You know, we don't talk about people being the diabetic patient in room 4
or
asthmatic in room 18. And the same way we don't talk about the obese person. It's a person with obesity. It's a person. But this is part of who they are. And it's important to acknowledge that. It's important for them to figure out what that means for them, and important for them to understand that things may be different after effective treatment like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned your work in the bariatric surgery area. Tell us more about that and who's a candidate for that step?
Well, you know, again, this is the patients with severe obesity. And I think parents feel like, oh my gosh, they just suggested surgery for my child. What is that about? And I think, you know, the guideline it was written to really say, you know, this is something that not for everybody, but for patients with severe obesity who are having health issues, they need to be made aware that there is an effective treatment, that there are effective treatments. You know, and I think we all say like, oh my gosh, medication is a step short of surgery. And it is, sort of, because we actually have much more data around surgery. Those studies have been going on for years. Studies like the Fabs Five, Teen Labs, which was done here in the U.S. Fabs Five was done internationally and here. And another one called the AMIS Project that was done mostly in Scandinavia.
Interesting.
And those studies really demonstrate the effectiveness of bariatric surgery in treatment of severe obesity. So before the medications, that was sort of the only option we had. And it's still very effective for a lot of patients.
I had one patient in my practice, and it was very successful. But I love that in our institution, you're absolutely right. It was a multidisciplinary, meaning she had the physicians that were part of her team and the psychologists who were part of her team to support her, nutritionists, everything, because this was a big change for her to undertake. And let's then go with, I'm starting to think of, when thinking about that patient specifically, let's back up to medicine, but then we can go to the surgery, insurance, coverage, financial burdens of these meds. What are you seeing in that aspect?
Well, you know, and that's a great question too, Sarah, because, you know, this is not an either or sort of proposition for a lot of these patients. You know, we mentioned, like, you don't do medications in isolation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't do medications. You do medications and you do surgery. So
okay.
It can sometimes be all hands on deck. And so there's a lot of, it takes always time for insurers to catch up to the science on things. Mm-hmm. And so what we find is that there are patients who we have to really struggle for them to get coverage. It's getting better. I will say that it's getting better. We're beginning to accept obesity as a chronic illness that requires support from insurers. We're making progress, but we have to continue in that regard. We have a lot of work to go. There are a lot of places where it's not covered. There are a lot of places where they will not cover it for weight loss. So you have to demonstrate, you have to use it for insulin resistance or other things that the patient might be having. So it's a little bit of a semantic thing. I mean, we're treating both, but there's still a weight bias in this world that, you know, this is all about diet and exercise. There are no other factors to trigger this. It's something that's a little bit alarming. I would say more than a little bit alarming, actually, that, you know, we're hearing a little bit from the higher ups again that, like, oh, this is just about, you know, you don't need medication. You just need to do X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, well, that's not the case for some of our patients who are suffering from this because there's a genetic component. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, one of the stories that's in that link that I mentioned is of a patient who had a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. And her brain tumor affected the part of her hypothalamus that affects appetite regulation.
Interesting. Wow.
That, you know, her, how is that a personal failing?
Right.
Whether she never feels full. So, you know, we have a long way to go to get insurers and get people to treat these kids with compassion and patients with compassion and not judgment.
And I do have to say, I worry about significant financial barriers for patients, especially those with lower income, and Medicaid coverage for these medications are limited. And, you know, the recent article headline from MAHA in, you know, early June that didn't include, the agenda didn't include expanding those coverage. I worry that people are going to find other ways to get the medication, and that may not really be a better option.
You mean find something on the internet?
Yes. So I know we're laughing, but I think we're laughing because it's so silly, but it's true. I know that these things are available, and I want to caution everybody out there that's listening that you really need to talk to your doctor when it comes to these medications and making sure that you're getting these prescriptions from a reliable source. Am I right?
You know, we definitely are the choir for pediatricians. Do we think your pediatrician should be involved in big decisions like this?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, 100%. you don't want to be doing things like this, like just about everything else. You want to be making these decisions with your pediatrician. And you really want them to be using good science to help inform that decision.
Yes, thank you for reinforcing that. And I also want to reinforce too, just going back to the fact that these are, like you said, not just a one-stop shop, that they're all parts that can be utilized with your physician, can guide you to nutrition. Their movement is important, but each one of these are not the be-all, end-all.
You know, Sarah, you and I have the good fortune of being Ohioans, and we live in a state that has, even if your pediatrician or your family practitioner is not comfortable with these, if they're not comfortable with these medications, they have access to a lot of really good pediatric facilities that can help your family medicine doc kind of get you the help that you need. We have a lot of really good resources that, yeah, this is a discussion you really want to keep with your physician.
Yes, and what I hear you talking about is that there are certain clinics that are multidisciplinary, like one that you were involved in, where your pediatrician can refer you to, and they can find the best fit for what it is that's really going to help you with your severe obesity.
Correct.
I love it. Oh, you know, you and I could talk all day, and I just want to thank you so much for helping us separate the facts about these meds, and especially these medications for kids. It's always good having you on the show. It's
my pleasure, Sarah. I love talking with you too. I'm sure we could go have a 4-hour podcast.
Absolutely.
I don't want to hear that.
Well, this episode reminds us that these tools, while powerful, as we mentioned several times, are not a one-size-fits-all. They're not quick fixes. They're just one piece of that bigger puzzle centered on health, not appearance. So if this is something you heard today that made you think differently or helped you understand this complex topic just a little more clearly, please share it with a friend or a colleague. You can find all the links that we mentioned and trusted resources in the show notes, including the AAP guidelines and more information on medications as we discussed. And if you haven't already, hit subscribe so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. Until next time, keep growing, keep learning, and remember, good health starts with really good information. And let's grow up together.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.